Let's celebrate American poetry by listening to the late, great W.S. Merwin. The former U.S. Poet Laureate wrote nearly 30 poetry collections, along with numerous books of essays, memoir, and translations before he died on the Ides of March, 2019. A longtime conservationist and resident of Hawaii, Merwin lived on an abandoned pineapple plantation atop a dormant volcano that he transformed with cultivations of endangered indigenous island plants. Though he liked his quiet life, he also enjoyed traveling and spreading his gospel of poetry.
I do believe that poetry should matter to more people. It's natural to like poetry. When people rediscover it, I'm very happy because I think that's the way it ought to be.
Stay with us to hear the past American voice of W.S. Merwin today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Born in New York City in September 1927, William Stanley Merwin was the son of a Presbyterian minister. Raised in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, his writing moved from childhood hymns to radio plays until he discovered poetry at Yale. His seven-decade career went from his first book, A Mask for Janice, awarded the 1952 Yale Younger Poets Prize by H.L. Auden, to his 2017 collection, The Essential W.S. Merwin. Recognized with nearly every major literary honor, including the National Book Award, a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and twice serving as U.S. Poet Laureate, his 2010 goals for that role were to emphasize both literature by Native peoples and about the environment. We'll start with a poem about a favorite topic from his book, The River Sound. Here's W.S. Merwin with What is a Garden?
All day working happily down near the stream bed, the light passing into the remote opalescence it returns to as the year wakes toward winter. A season of rain in a year already rich in rain, with masked light emerging on all sides in the new leaves of the palms quietly waving. Time of mud and slipping and of overhearing the water under the sloped ground going on whispering as it travels. Time of rain thundering at night, and of rocks rolling and echoing in the torrent, and of looking up after noon through the high branches to see fine rain drifting across the sunlight over the valley that was abused and at last left to fill with thickets of rampant aliens bringing habits but no stories under the mango trees, already vast as clouds. There I keep discovering beneath the tangle the ancient shaping of water to which the light of an hour comes back as to a secret. And there I planted young palms in places I had not pondered until then. I imagined their roots setting out in the dark, knowing without knowledge. I kept trying to see them standing in that bed of the valley in the light that would come.
What is a Garden? From the River Sound, published in 1999, the year the poet was in Kansas City for Rockhurst University's Midwest Poet Series and UMKC's Cockafair Chair Lecture. The author of the book, Understanding W.S. Merwin, also interviewed him for us. Here's H.L. Hicks.
One of the aspects of that poem that interests me is that phrase, rampant aliens bringing habits but no stories, in part because of the echoes that that has with Aristotle and Camus both and their concern with habits and overcoming habits and so on. But also, I'm wondering whether that phrase could stand as a kind of condensation of your sense of Hawaii and its recent history and part of your interest in that and the pressures that aliens have brought to bear on the islands.
Oh, very much. I think of it that way. And I was thinking of the alien species, the invasive alien species coming in. But I mean, we're one of the invasive alien species.
Right.
And when you do that, you come in with a kind of rootlessness in which the stories that you may have come from somewhere else, you're imposing on the place, but they don't really have anything to do with it. And this is true of many of the kinds of growth. The valley that I was thinking about was full of a weed tree that came from Brazil in 1912, and scrub guavas that came in the 19th century, lantana that came when they brought cattle in the 19th century. It was far richer than the Galapagos that excited Darwin so much. And it had developed farther out of touch of any other land than anywhere else on the planet. So that this incredibly rich flora and fauna there was highly vulnerable because there were very few natural enemies.
Right.
And so some of the birds stopped flying. There were several species of flightless birds at the beginning. There were practically no poisonous plants. There are no poisonous snakes. And when invasive species came in, they just took over because there was nothing to defend
it. Yeah.
And to try to reinstate Hawaiian species is very difficult.
Right.
Because the disturbance is very often a final disturbance. If you make it, you can't undo it. And the ecologists and environmentalists in Hawaii get very, very upset about what's happening.
Right.
And there are more extinct species in Hawaii in the last 150 years than in the whole of North America.
And part of what intrigues me about your approach to Hawaii and your concern with those issues is two-sided. One is the relation of humans to the rest of nature and the influence of humans on how the rest of nature operates. And the other is the social interaction between cultures with different histories and their meetings. And so, you know, you've talked about paradox as a source of poetry. And I'm interested in how you confront that paradox of being the Anglo-European, now citizen of Hawaii, yourself an alien, coming in and yet trying to learn the culture, work within the culture, to understand the history of the biota there and restore it to a certain point. Even the paradox that all species to Hawaii ultimately are aliens, brought somehow or other to the mountains when they originated. How do you work through all those for yourself in terms of your activity and as well as your writing?
Well, by trying to have respect for the place in all of those respects. I mean, the indigenous people, the Hawaiian people, and the language and that culture, what's left of it, without trying to pretend that I know a great deal about it or that I can tell Hawaiian people how they should behave or act or what they should do. But also, the title of that poem is What is a Garden? It has led me to question what one is doing in making a garden. I started some 20 years ago by trying to take this piece of land and restore Hawaiian edge of rainforest. Can't be done. I mean, the disturbance, as I suggested a while ago, is something that very often you cannot undo. The word reforestation, I think, is a word that should be stricken from the language because we do not reforest. We don't know how to reforest. A forest knows how to make a forest. We don't know. We know how to plant things, but we don't know what to plant. We don't know where to plant them. And one of the things that gets destroyed in a very fragile environment like that of the Hawaiian Islands, before even Polynesians came, before humans came at all, was the most remarkable thing about all forests, which is the social relations. Trees don't exist in solitude. They exist in relation to fungi and to other trees and to undergrowth and to insects and to birds and to all of these things. And when you deforest, you don't know how to put it back. Even if you went in with unlimited money and the best will in the world, you wouldn't know how to put it back. You can't go in and destroy a forest and put a few species back and think you've reforested. The thing that does give hope is that there's a moment when you restore a kind of biodiversity, when it begins to do something itself. If you put the wrong things in, you may have put in invasive species and you may have put in things that have bad relations to each other, and you can make mistakes. But I've hoped to see in several places where large botanical gardens exist adjacent to undisturbed rainforest, that there could be studies of how the rainforest can take over areas adjoining itself and go back into forest. Something we don't know anything about. And it would be a very valuable thing to know.
Right.
You know, it's something that we can't do. If you destroy a human language, you can't put it back. There are arguments that you've heard, I'm sure, about Irish Gaelic and the bringing it back.
Right.
And it may work, but it's only because it wasn't entirely lost. Once it's lost, you cannot start from scratch and teach it again because you end up with an artificial thing. You may end up with something that works, but it doesn't work the way the original worked. Language, as we know, develops in ways that are mysterious to us.
That's W.S. Merwin in 1999 on New Letters on the Air. He also talked about The Folding Cliffs, his 1998 book-length narrative poem about Hawaii's breathtaking beauty and tragic 19th century history. Again, here's H.L. Hicks.
What is it that made The Folding Cliffs become a poem? You've used different genres to talk about different things or to explore different things. I'm thinking of The Lost Upland, which is a set of stories about France and a particular region in France with which you have an intimate connection. And here's a narrative, something like those narratives in a way, about a place that you love. Why a poem? What made this become a poem instead of a set of stories?
Well, I was fascinated by that story, what little I knew about it, for many years. And at the beginning, I didn't even know whether I could write anything about it or whether I wanted to. But I went on being fascinated by the story. And I suppose that went on for about 12 years. And just as I was beginning some of the research that became The Folding Cliffs, I also was writing The Poems and the Vixen. And The Poems and the Vixen went on over quite a period of time. And I wasn't thinking of any connection between them, but by the time I'd come to the end of The Vixen, I had realized that if I was ever going to write anything about the story that is The Folding Cliffs, the only thing it could be was a poem, for a number of reasons. It could not be history. I'm not a historian. And we don't know enough to write history about that. It could not be a novel because I'm not a novelist and I don't know how to do that. And this is not the kind of characterization either that would work for a novel. And I wanted something that could, without changing its mode at all, be able to move from a Hawaiian woman at moments of intense feeling, chanting as she would have in that generation, to virtually verbatim letters from the Department of Health. It would be very hard for prose to do this. You'd have to find all sorts of ways of rigging it with italics and quotation marks and changes of type and things like that, and be documenting it. That was just not what I wanted to do. I wanted the continuity that a poem has, not the kind of blackboard of facts and documentation. I wanted something different, something more continuous, and I think that only a poem could do that. Then what kind of poem would it be? And it seemed to me that something that I had been doing in The Vixen was the thing that I had come to that would enable me to do it. Mm-hmm. So it's not the same form as The Poems in The Vixen, but it's related to the poems. It's instead of the chapters being 40 pages each, they're one page each, but there are 40 of them, which means that they're in short sections. They're short as single poems, and they can be read as single poems. And that was the idea. Mm-hmm. I think it's very hard for people to read long stretches of poetry now. And perhaps it always was, you know. I think that the great oral traditions were mainly people, the Song of Roland, this isn't true, but it's probably true of the Poem of the Cid, that when people came into the marketplace, when the juglares came in, they probably didn't know the whole poem. They knew part of the poem. And people came down and they heard part of the poem, and then they would come down another time and they would hear another part of the poem. It was like collecting war cards, you know, or something like that, until you had a complete set, until you had the whole story. It was part of the excitement of hearing it. And, of course, they were exciting. Also, you know, I've been impatient, I suppose, for many years with critical theories about how poetry does not have to have a subject. This is the sort of post-phenomenological way of approaching things. Wonderful writers among them. But some of it's been very destructive, I think, and very limiting. It has not been liberating.
Right.
And the idea that narrative and poetry have nothing to do with each other is not a help. It's a straitjacket that we don't need. There shouldn't be anything that poetry can't do. It's an infinite form. Why shouldn't it tell a story? It's always told stories. But it's told stories differently from prose. So, I mean, that was as much theoretical thought as I gave to it, because it's a practical matter how you get along with a poem.
Right.
And finally, one night, I was thinking of Pi'ilani and her going back to her husband's grave alone over those cliffs, and I started writing the poem. You know, I thought this was a tentative beginning, and I thought, no, that's the beginning.
Well, even the structure with the connection between the main sections where the last word in one section is the title of the next section and the first word of the next section reminds one of very traditional English language forms like the Crown of Sonnets, John Donne, the canonization, or something like that.
The other connection of having the last word, the first word of the following section, and also of the title, that's the way Hawaiian chant is set up. All Hawaiian chants do that. They announce each stanza with a word, and then that's the first word of the stanza.
Yeah.
And then they end on a word, which becomes that of the next. And that's part of the form.
That's wonderful.
So the thing is saying you can consider this as a chant. You consider it as a narrative chant.
Yeah. Well, would you read a section from the Folding Cliffs?
Suppose I read the very opening section, because it's based on what we know and probably on all we ever will know about a Hawaiian family, a man, a woman, and a child, just over 100 years ago, about 1890. They're in their 30s. He's a cowboy, a very remarkable and, in fact, legendary cowboy, and a very much admired man. She was a beauty, and they'd been sweethearts since they were children, and married and had a child who was 10 years old at the time of this story. He's been diagnosed with leprosy and told that he must go to Kalaupapa, which is the leprosy settlement, which means the family will be torn apart. And this was the worst thing about the disease for the Hawaiians. It wasn't dying from it or even disfigurement. It was the tearing apart of the family. And this family decided they would not be separated, and they would go instead over into this incredibly remote and dangerous, because 4,000-foot cliffs, valley on the north slope of Kauai, and join a small band of fugitives who also had leprosy, and that they would not be separated in their lifetime, and that they would resist authority, and that's what they did. In the course of the story, a very ambitious sheriff comes and tries to clean out the valley of these fugitives and tries to ambush Ko'olau, the cowboy, and Ko'olau kills him. And then they send the army after him. The army can't find him and finally gives up. And she watches her little boy die of leprosy. They know that the little boy has leprosy too. And the child dies of leprosy, and they bury him, and then he finally dies of leprosy, and she buries him, and then she lives on alone in the valley for many months before she goes home. And this is, after she goes home, she hears rumors that his body has been discovered, dug up, and is being sold as souvenirs along with the gun. She goes back with other people several times, but finally she goes back alone for the last time and to assure herself. And it's as she starts back on this very dangerous trip over the mountain and down the cliffs that the poem opens, after all of this has happened. And she's alone at night going over the mountain. Climbing in the dark, she felt the small stones turn along the spine of the path whose color kept rising in her mind. Burned in color, moment of rust, dried blood color, other color, gone color by day. And she knew what color was there when she could not see it, and when one of the stars was the darkness before any breath of daylight, and the way was in her feet again. The star of Kauea rushed between clouds when the dawn wind came toward her down across the ridges of the mountain, carrying the scent of water from the peak of Waialeale. At a high twist of the trail far down to the left, behind her over the naked roots of the slope and the widening hollow of Waiaka, where the folds of the mountain were still touched by the moon, she saw the sea outside the curve of coast glinting past Waimea, beyond the dark land and the hidden houses. In one of them her father was invisible in sleep, and past there the sea outside Kekaha, where she had been born by the shore of Oʻomano, all of it barely a shadow from which she had set out, and nobody had heard her go. Even the dogs in the moonlight never barked when she went past, looked up and watched, and never barked, knowing who she was. And with the next step, that whole horizon was gone behind the mountain. The blackness beginning to the right of her was the chasm of Waimea. The air running from the edge of it rustled the finer leaves of the koas. Above her, the voices of the plovers stitched the night.
The past American voice of W.S. Merwin, reading from his 1998 book, The Folding Cliffs, a fictional but fact-based Hawaiian tale, published the year before this conversation with poet H.L. Hicks for New Letters on the Air.
The process of identification really strikes me in this poem. Really, the central protagonist is Pi'ilani.
Yes.
Yet there are any number of characters with whom one identifies, and characters that one resents and dismisses or condemns, I guess. And I'm interested in how one's own personal place in the world gets expanded into something more engaging than that, something that's beyond a sort of confessional poetry and yet remains intensely personal.
Well, I think what you're talking about probably has to do with something that I would describe as affinity, I mean, and luck. I mean, you find a story in this case. I didn't know that there were these points of affinity when I started. I mean, I didn't know that the missionary would be the kind of person that he turns out to be. And incidentally, he's a figure who develops, at least I believe he develops in the course of the story. By the time he dies, he's not the figure that he was when he first got there. And one of the great risks in the poem, of course, was that the central figure really is not only Hawaiian, but a woman. And for a Caucasian man to write, I mean, this is taking a terrible risk. And I expected that someone would blame me for it, but no one has so far. And some Hawaiian women read it early, and their responses were very affirmative, so I was very pleased about that. Because I mean, Hawaiians don't naturally accept things like that. They're
right.
quite able to say, go away. Right. I mean, who are you to say anything about
this? And yet that's a risk that it seems to me poetry needs to take.
Yes.
I think we've lost sight of this ambition for universality in poetry in our sense that white males can only write about white male experience and African Americans can only write about African American experience. That we then lose the ability to try to enter into the other person's experience, to try to understand an experience as a universal, as something we share with other people.
And then we lose all the projections of these different experiences, too, which are very, very important. I mean, what's the relation between Dante and the figure of Odysseus, you know? I mean, there's a huge distance, but the imagination is what's filling it, filling that one up. And if it is authentic, if the authenticity of it is somewhere there, it makes the whole thing real, and it is valuable, so it should be.
Right. As a last section to read, would you read section 39 towards the end of the book? This figure, the flute player, this sort of ghost who appears at the end, would you read that section and talk a little bit about what the importance is for you of that figure of the flute player? What is it that makes that the necessary place for the poem to end?
He breaks the frame, you know. I mean, when the Navajos make a rug, there's always one thread at the bottom that runs out of the pattern. I felt that if one had this sudden story, someone else who dies in totally different circumstances, it was like a sudden beam of light coming on it from a different angle and opening it up in a different way and saying, this isn't a neat little thing that you can isolate. It runs out into places that you don't know.
Right.
And it should be quite startling to have that figure. But anyway, this is late in the story and where you have a whole different view of a different part of that society and of the impact of that terrible disease. I told you I have a sister. She used to work out at Makaveli, and she knew the Knudsens, and now for years she has been working for a family on the other side of the island, up near Kilauea, by the name of Ewart. They have a big farm and pastures up that way, and dairy cattle up on the hills. She says it is very beautiful, and they are good to her, and she likes it there, and keeps telling me to come and see her, but it is a long trip, and she does not get to Waimea very often. But she came to see me last week, and Kealia showed her your book, and my sister was trying to read it, and Kealia read some parts of it to her, and later she told us something that had happened up the coast there. She used to say that one of the things she liked there was the way the Ewarts played music. She said they all had their houses near each other, and the families and their children would all get together in the evening several times a week, and every one of them played some instrument, and so after the milking and dinner, they would sit and play music for hours with the candles burning. She says they have a piano, and they have violins, and even a harp, and one night when they stopped, they heard a flute playing all by itself out in the dark. They listened, and then the flute stopped, and they waited, and then they went back to playing, but listening, and did not hear it again. But a few nights later, when they stopped what they were playing to play it over, they heard the flute again, and it went on playing where they had stopped. And Mr. Ewart put down his violin and opened the door onto the long lanai, and the flute stopped right there, and they all sat listening. And one of the Ewart girls who had been to college said, "It must be a ghost," but they sat there with the door open, and after a while went back to playing the same music and listening, and then Mr. Ewart said, "I know that flute playing," and they looked at him when he said it. But then he went back to playing, and a few nights later, they heard the flute music coming from the pastures again. When they had finished playing, and Mr. Ewart opened the door and picked up a lantern that he had ready there, and they followed him out toward where the sound seemed to be coming from, but the playing had stopped when the door opened, and they were frightened and held up lanterns, staying close behind Mr. Ewart. That night they found nothing, and then the next day Mr. Ewart found hoof prints under a tree, and hoof prints leading toward the farm of a neighbor who had been there longer than they had, a family from Germany named Bertelmann, with a dairy farm like their own. And they all remembered Christian Bertelmann, who had been a child when they came there and had grown up into a tall young man who loved music and sang, and who used to come for a time and play the flute with them in the evenings. And he had represented Kauai in the legislature, but that had been years before. And then they had not seen him for a long time, and the family said he was sick, and then he was away in a hospital. But only last month Mr. Ewart had heard that the sickness was leprosy, and that they had dressed up Christian as somebody else and sent him away to Japan, where there was supposed to be a cure for that now, but they never cured him. And to get him back this time, they had him dressed up as a tall woman in mourning, who had come from Germany in response to a bid for a German wife that one of the Bertelmanns was said to have published in a German newspaper. "Their house is built around a courtyard," she told me, "which nobody can see from outside, and they built him a room of his own inside the courtyard, and in there he could take off those clothes, and only the family ever saw him, and to console himself he would play the flute, or he would go out at night and ride his horse across the pastures, and then he would go and listen to the music from the Ewarts, where he used to play. And then he began to take his flute out with him and play when he heard them. And then they heard him, and he stopped doing that. And they thought the ghost had gone, but he still played farther out, where they could not hear him, or could not be sure they were hearing anything. And then he died, my sister told me. And they said that happened not long ago, and she said that only the family knows where he is buried." And she stopped, and they sat hearing the long, low wave ending on the shore. "A flute," Pi'ilani said. "There was a man in Kalalau down by the stream who played the flute. And when I heard it, I would go on thinking I heard it all the next day."
That's from the late W.S. Merwin's novel and poetry, The Folding Cliffs, his tribute to Hawaii, where he died at home on March 15, 2019, at age 91. Interviewed in 1999 by poet H.L. Hicks, this is just one of several shows with Merwin going back to 1979. They're on our website, newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, this show was originally produced with Linda Scher, Laura Spencer and Amber Papini, and later with Annie Walsh and Dennis Conroe. Thanks today to Natalie Stein and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.